How to rebuild civilization on the Bible. Last week we looked at how civilizations commit suicide. Well, this is now the positive, the counter. How do we actually practically rebuild civilization on the Bible? Nehemiah 2 verse 17, see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. Does anyone recognize the background of this picture? What is that picture of?
Dresden.
The burning of Dresden, Valentine's Day, 1945. This, I've seen it on color video footage being shown in the Imperial War Museum in England, where they're showing what they took from the air of the incineration, the firestorm created in Dresden with the 1,000 bomber raids. They had a 10 o'clock raid. And then when the fire brigade and others were trying to work with the fires, 1,000 bombers came over after midnight and bombed it again. When we were trying to sort things out in the morning, the Americans came with another 1,000 bomber raid and hit the same target. And this is what Dresden looked like afterwards, a few days later. The monument of Martin Luther on top of one of the churches, a monument of Martin Luther in front of the Frauenkirche on the ground, blown off the pedestal of the monument. Before they rebuilt the city, they rebuilt the monument of Martin Luther. And this is symbolic of what we're talking about. People, mostly women and old men, because the younger men, all the men who'd been fighting, were by the millions taken to slave labor and to Russia. Very few returned, and many went to France by the hundreds of thousands to do slave labor there. And so it was for the old and for the young women to rebuild their cities, brick by brick, without machinery. But this is a parable of how we must rebuild our Christian civilization, which has been dismantled, subverted, and undermined in our lifetime. In fact, the 20th century has been the great anti-Christian century of destroying, subverting, sabotaging, and betraying Christian civilization. Interestingly, you go to Dresden today, and not only have they rebuilt the church, and you can see by the blackened bricks, some of those are the incinerated bricks from the firestorm, which they built in just to remind them of the fact that they've rebuilt from the ashes. And so when you go today, you could hardly imagine this entire city was completely destroyed, but they rebuilt it, and they rebuilt the churches to the original specifications. See the trouble we are in? Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. It is a disgrace that so much of our Christian civilization is in ruins. Martin Luther calls people back to the Bible. That's the Protestant call. Just consider a more recent example from this year. As the symbol of France, Notre Dame Cathedral was burned almost certainly by sabotage, although the French president ruled that out while the fires were still burning and before they put the fire out and before any forensics had been done. Normally, you need weeks of investigation to confirm after a fire whether it was arson, sabotage, deliberate or not. Yet the president just ruled out, no, it's definitely not sabotage, it's an electrical fault. How does a president know while a fire is going? So when they're trying to cover it up, you know one thing, they're lying. But the facts are, many hundreds of churches in France have been attacked by arson just in recent years. Here's just a few in the last year that happened in the 12 months before Notre Dame caught fire in April 2019. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Just as there were arsonists and there were incendiaries who have put fire to Notre Dame and many other churches in France, so there are others who, not necessarily in a physical way, are destroying the actual building blocks of Christianity in our society. Isaiah 58 verse 12 says, those from among you shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. This is a lot of our calling. This is the calling of Protestants, of reformers. We are to rebuild that which is Christian and biblical and healthy and right and noble and just in society. From the book of Nehemiah, we get our battle plan, Operation Nehemiah. First of all, information. Nehemiah researched the problem. He personally investigated. He went around the walls of Jerusalem and he ascertained what the problem was. And then he devised a plan. When Nehemiah sounded the trumpet, all were to rally to that part of the wall that was under attack for the common defense. The work is extensive and spread out. We are widely separated from each other along the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. And so his men were to work with a weapon in one hand and a tool in the other. After information, he had intercession. You read a lot of prayer in the book of Nehemiah. And there was investment. Nehemiah invested his time, his money, his resources, his way of life into rebuilding Jerusalem. He threw his whole body, mind, and soul into it. In the same way, we need to sacrifice and work for the necessary resources to support the people, the publications, and the projects that will seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And implementation. Nehemiah got information. He was involved in intercession. He sought involvement of the people. He invested in it. And then there was an implementation of the plan. Nehemiah did not allow any obstacle to prevent him from completing this task. Although he had limited resources, little experience, and minimal security, he did not hesitate. Despite criticism and slander and discouragement and opposition, in less than 2 months, Nehemiah had transformed a pile of rubble into a secure wall for defending his city. So Nehemiah is a great example for us. Today is Thanksgiving Day in the United States, a good Christian holiday. Well, I don't know that everyone necessarily remembers what Thanksgiving's for. In fact, I've seen American school textbooks that have been shown to me that Thanksgiving was when the pilgrims gave thanks to the Indians. Literally, no mention of giving thanks to God. Can you imagine that there's school textbooks that can lie so blatantly and try and disguise the Christian origins? It is our calling to stand alone, if necessary, against the multitude, to go upstream, to not go downstream like dead fish, but to make a stand against the world. Civilizations fall and crumble. We looked last week at how civilizations commit suicide, and we see a lot of disturbing trends at work in our own times. In fact, a lot of the great civilizations of the past today are just a pile of ruins in a desert, in what used to be paradises. John Adams, who was a president of the United States, the second president of the United States, he said, "Violence is not necessary to destroy civilization. Each civilization is dying because of indifference towards the unique values that created it." There was a pastor who said to his deacons, "The problem in a church today is ignorance and apathy." And one of his elders said, "Well, I don't know and I don't care." Which is the whole point. Ignorance and apathy. That's the problem. People they don't know what made their civilization. It's like it just appeared. They don't understand how pioneers built it out of wilderness and in wild conditions and what it took to create peaceful and advanced levels of civilization and standards of living. And they don't care about the uniqueness, and so they do nothing to maintain it, and so it collapses. Just take Detroit, once one of the richest cities in America. That's what it looked like a century ago, and that's what the same street looks like now. This house is that one. Everything else just rubble. That's just one example. We could keep people here for a long time. Socialism is the philosophy of failure. It is the creed of ignorance, and it is the gospel of envy. Christianity started as a persecuted religion, at first only really followed by slaves. At one time, Christianity was so persecuted and crushed, it was for the monks, the missionaries on Iona Island, who studied the word, who went and started to re-evangelize England, and from there, Europe. It was these Lindisfarne and Iona are considered two little missionary islands or bases that re-evangelized Europe after the Dark Ages hit, in immediate aftermath of the fall of the Roman Empire, and they brought in a great Christian age. And when people speak about the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages, it's false. The Middle Ages were not dark. There was a very short period of Dark Ages. But in just a matter of a few decades, great Christian kings like King Alfred the Great managed to bring in a new age of learning and of education, schools, and law. They said you could hang valuable jewels on a branch by a busy roadside and it would be safe. Said there was such respect for law under the dooms of King Alfred, the Saxon king of Wessex. And Christianity flourished under godly kings and godly leaders in Europe in the Middle Ages, and they won over the Vikings and won over the different enemies of the faith, so that even the great Viking threat turned to Christianity. And these are some of the stave churches built in Norway by the Vikings, who had terrorized Europe so much that it was written into the creeds, the liturgies of the church, Lord, from the fury of the Norsemen, deliver us. And yet the Vikings came to Christ. The Saxons came to Christ. And the churches and monasteries and cathedrals testify to the winning of these peoples. This is Salzburg, the great salt mountain and the castle on it, a city of Mozart. Beautiful castles, magnificent churches, cathedrals, advanced civilization. This church was built in the 12th century. In the 1100s, they were building this high and this tall, 900 years ago. Stained glass windows like this. Phenomenal achievements. This is Christianity, which turned the Dark Ages into the age of cathedrals, stained glass windows, libraries, and universities. There was nothing dark about the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages were the ages in which Europe was Christianized, evangelized, discipled. And they built magnificent cathedrals like these and magnificent castles like Neuschwanstein in Bavaria, Bayern. Literally, the waters flowed and civilization advanced. And you can see, like St. Paul's Cathedral, this built in 1660s. Absolutely incredible advanced technology. This is 350 years ago. At the time that Cape Town was being settled by Jan van Riebeck, they were building St. Paul's Cathedral, which just stands as a tremendous monument. St. Paul's, of course, was built after the Great Fire of London in 1666. Along came great queens like Queen Victoria, an evangelical, Bible-believing Christian who is part of William Wilberforce's Reformation Society. And her husband was an even more stout and devout evangelical leader, Lutheran from Germany, Prince Albert. And what an extraordinary advanced civilization was built at that time. And even today, you can see, and I've been in St. Paul's for Evensong, the evening Eucharist, and what an experience. Every day they have at least two services, normally three or four. I guess there's weddings, funerals, and so on there too. It's the main parish church of London. You can go throughout Europe and you can see the highest building in many places is the church or the cathedral. And you can see the spires of different churches sticking out all over, reminding you of the Christian faith that built Europe. The farm areas, beautiful, magnificent. Along with the gate, you've got the church to the right. And you can see advanced civilizations built around the churches. The churches, and here again, you can see along with the bridges, there's churches, spires all over, just showing you this is where civilization grew out of the great cathedrals. And these magnificent architectural masterpieces point to the skies, to the inspiration, to the Lord, the Creator. And so when you compare architecture and art then with architecture and art now, it's just no contest. It's belachlich, it's shameful, it's embarrassing, what they call art and architecture today. So we call to rebuild civilization. Can I draw your attention again to how many trees and how high the tree line was of forest around Lion's Head, and how green was the area in the center of Cape Town, and how clean it was. Just take a few pictures of Johannesburg not that long ago. We're talking about when I first visited Joburg in the 1970s. This is what Johannesburg looked like in the 1970s. They called it the richest piece of real estate on earth, where the streets are paved with gold. It was a city built on gold. The British Parliament called Johannesburg the richest piece of real estate on earth, because it was built on the Witwatersrand. And today it is a shambles of a ghetto, of a mess, of a crime zone. And so we've got corruption. We've got massive amount of state capture, government failure on every level. Ecclesia Reformata Reformanda Est, the church having been reformed, must still be reformed. So what can we do to reform the church? Well, the first battle is life, fighting for the right to life of preborn babies, voting pro-life, and supporting life is a good beginning. The family is the basic building block of society. We need to ensure that our family is thoroughly grounded in the Word of God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. In fact, families are under attack because families are the most important institution of God's creation. It is the family unit. A father who works, provides, and protects, and hopefully guides and prays for too. A mother who nurtures and raises the children. A family, a home built on marriage, being a lifelong commitment between one man and one woman. All of these things are under attack. The idea of gender, identities, families, worshipping together, praying around the table, and of course being kind to animals too, who are also part of the extended family. All of this is part of our heritage. Children should be taught how to be Viking warriors, how to fight, how to defend. And yet today we've got youngsters being trained to be wimps, weeds and wets. We live in an age where tradition is one of the highest forms of rebellion. There's nothing you can do that more angers and makes incensed the enemies of Christianity than to hold to your gender-specific roles, believe in family, believe in having children, raising them in the love and the fear of the Lord. I mean, all these things are treason and thought crimes to the New World Order. And so to raise the rebel flag today is to believe in family. And you get girls in universities who say something when they say, what do you want to be? And say, I want to be a mother and a nurturer. And they will come under vicious attack, like, how dare you? How can you be so narrow-minded, so stupid? And they just throw them with every kind of manipulation. And, of course, the anti-male component on universities is in high gear as well. But that's why the Confederate flag now symbolizes more than just secession. It's secession from the world's destructive ways. All throughout Austria, Germany, and Switzerland Alps, you'll find the highest peaks all have crosses on top of them. Some mountaineers climbed up and they put up crosses to dominate every high point. And Switzerland has, if I remember right, 48 peaks over 4,000 meters. Now, Table Mountain's 1,000 meters. Switzerland's got 48 over 4,000 meters high. So it gives you an idea of how many peaks are, and apparently every peak in Austria, Switzerland, and Germany has a cross on it. The battle today is to fight for pro-woman, pro-baby, pro-life, pro-family. This is a protest in Paris where a million Parisians, I had no idea a million Parisians cared or had standards, marched for family against the legalization of so-called homosexual marriage. Marine Le Pen, someone to watch, her aunt Marine Le Pen is famous for leading the opposition, the National Front in France, and could easily be the next president of France. But her young niece is only, I think, 24. She's a fine, dedicated pro-life Christian and well-spoken. If you Google a message of hers, a conservative club, I think in America, she gives a message in English quite eloquently. But the French are not all gone. There's a lot of French who still hold to tradition and family and Christianity and against Islam. This is a rally of a million Parisians against the government's plans to legalize homosexual marriage. What do schools really teach children? They teach you that truth comes from authority. Intelligence is the ability to remember and repeat what the teacher tells you. Accurate memory and repetition are rewarded. Non-compliance is punished. And you must conform intellectually and you must conform socially. This is what they're teaching. This has nothing to do with education. It's everything to do with indoctrination. Today, you've got hear no intelligent design, see no intelligent design, and speak no intelligent design. If you doubt that, see the Expelled film by Ben Stein. Hear no creation, see no creation, speak no creator. That's public school indoctrination. So if a mother was to be honest when her daughter asked, why do I have to go to school? So that you can be molded into a state-approved homogenous drone that cannot think outside the prescribed consensus. You will learn to repeat information instead of how to think for yourself so that you don't become a threat to the status quo. When you graduate, you'll get a job, pay your taxes in order to perpetuate the corporate system of indented servitude, which is a new feudal system of slavery, is another word for it. That, in a nutshell, is actually what's going on in our public schools today. George Orwell warned us over 70 years ago, if people cannot write well, they cannot think well. If they cannot think well, others will do their thinking for them, and that's what's going on in the world today. You get people just repeating whatever is in the adverts and the media, and they just repeat it as though there's something original. They're all giving the same mantra. Nearly 500 years ago, German reformer Professor Martin Luther said, I'm much afraid that schools will prove to be wide gates to hell unless they diligently labor in explaining the Holy Scriptures, engraving them in the hearts of youth. I advise no one to place his child where the Scriptures do not reign paramount. Every institution in which men are not constantly occupied with the Word of God must become corrupt. Now, I'm sure many of you recognize this university as Stellenbosch. How many can identify this university? Rhodes University in Grahamstown. This is actually where Tarrant studied journalism. That's the 1820 settlers monument up on the hill. Sadly, if I gave you a current picture, you wouldn't see any of these trees here. They've chopped down all those forests. Martin Luther said, I'm not permitted to let my love be so merciful as to tolerate and endure false doctrine. We mustn't be tolerant of lies. A doctor should not be tolerant of disease and infection. A policeman shouldn't be tolerant of crime and corruption. A fireman shouldn't be tolerant of fire hazards. A preacher should not be tolerant of lies. Neither should a good journalist or teacher. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ. So, the biggest battle is the battle for the next generation. The Bible tells us that God is seeking godly offspring. As parents and teachers, our first priority is to ensure that our children love God and love His Word. Some of this can be taught, but most of it can only be caught. It's vital we teach our children to love and honor God and His Word, but it's even more vital that they see their parents and their teachers, who hopefully are the same, love God and His Word. Our daily example is far more important teaching tool than our words. Whatever we teach our children, we need to model by example to them, because children don't really care what you say if they don't see that you do and believe it yourself. Education starts with the Bible. Libraries. The fear of the Lord is a beginning of wisdom. Can anyone identify what this is? It's Oxford University for sure. And do you know which actual part of Oxford this is? It's the premier of, they've got over 36 colleges in Oxford. And this one is Christ Church, which is where Whitfield and Wesley studied. Christ Church, that's one of the colleges in Oxford. You cannot trust any government, state, with the molding of the minds of future voters. It's a conflict of interest. God commands his people, learn not the way of the heathen. The control of education should be in the hands of parents, and the content of education must be Bible-based. Control and content. Children do not belong to the state. Children are not made an image of Caesar. They're made an image of God and then entrusted to the parents to bring them up and nurture in the admonition of the Lord. All parents must at least become involved in a parent-teacher association of their local schools and take an active role in the education of the young according to biblical principles. But in my experience, PTAs are primarily about fundraising. It's got virtually nothing to do with the education, the curriculum, the teachers, and the program of the school. So the PTA is something, but you have got no power there. You need to be on the school governing body, actually, to make any impact at all. But even then, even with an independent Christian school, you would struggle because it's the textbooks and the teachers. Christian schools should be supported, although in our experience, most Christian schools are using state curriculum. Homeschooling should be prayerfully considered by all those parents who have the means to do so. In fact, it's a lot cheaper and more practical to homeschool your child than to deal with all the damage that's done by state education. Quite aside from the fact that actually it's extremely expensive doing state education. If you think of the uniforms, and you think of the fundraisers, and you think of not just the fees and everything else, and the transport and the time waste of transporting up and down. When homeschooling has no uniforms and your main expenses are textbooks, it's incredibly more practical to go into home education than a lot of others. Now, homeschooling is this radical idea of putting your children first and educating them yourself, which, of course, through most of history was the norm. Who pioneered the idea of state schooling? Karl Marx. When? 1848. Marxist Manifesto, Communist Manifesto, 1848. Karl Marx wrote in, for the first time, the idea that the state should control education, meaning schools, he meant indoctrination. Schools must be compulsory, they must be state-controlled, the teachers must be trained by the state, the teachers must be licensed by the state, the textbooks must be produced by the state. Why? Because churches and missions and families and homes had dominated education for millennia. And so no governments were interested in education. And Christianity pioneered education for all, and education for girls was only pioneered by Christianity. In fact, it was said by Augustine that Christian girls are better educated than male pagan philosophers. And that's going back to the 4th century. And so Christianity has been an education religion. By the 19th century, Karl Marx recognized there is no way we are going to beat Christian Europe unless we get education out of the hands of parents and the church and put in the hands of the state. And that's the background to state education. Successful people read every day. Unsuccessful people watch TV every day. Successful people compliment, unsuccessful criticize. Successful people embrace change, unsuccessful people fear change. Successful people forgive others, but unsuccessful people hold grudges. Successful people talk about ideas, but unsuccessful people talk about people. Just think of People magazine and all that sort of thing. What are they mostly about? Gossip, especially. What's the ridiculous thing on where they're listening to gossip about the characters in Hollywood? It's just, you see it at every checkout counter in America, but just gossip about others, and normally scandalous. A successful person is continuously learning, but unsuccessful people know it all. Successful people accept responsibility for their failures, but unsuccessful people blame others. General Ben Parton said he had never accept anyone on his staff who hadn't made serious mistakes. He said because anyone who couldn't point to serious mistakes that they'd made were either lying or blaming it or covering it up and blaming it on others, or even as seriously, they've never tried anything. Because if you're not willing to fail, that's the kind of person who's not willing to even try. It's better to have tried and failed and learned than a person who never tried anything. Successful people have a sense of gratitude. Unsuccessful people have a sense of entitlement. The worst thing you can do for any people is to give them a sense of entitlement. It's destroying them. Think how the Lord Jesus was so patient with sinners, but how he had no time and no mercy for the hypocrites. The Pharisees, he condemned them to hell mercilessly, like in Matthew 23, because people who have a sense of entitlement and who think that they know it all and are hypocrites, they are the firewood of hell. They will never be forgiven by God because they have no sense of guilt, no sense of gratitude, no sense of indebtedness to God. They'll never seek God's forgiveness because they are full of themselves. They are victims and everyone else is to blame and they're entitled. So this is the worst thing you can do, is to bring up a generation with a sense of entitlement and victimhood. You're destroying them. Successful people set goals and develop plans, but unsuccessful people never set goals. Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. So, what's involved in education? To educate the next generation, there's Accelerated Christian Education, ACE, which one of our daughters used, Bob Jones University, which another of our daughters, Andrea, graduated on. There's Christian Liberty Press, which all of our children have used at some stage. And there's Theocentric Christian Education, TC, which I think is probably the highest standard you can get in South Africa, run by Alison Shortridge. Emma went through TCE. And there's other good home schooling textbook providers who provide us with invaluable educational curriculums to enable us to make disciples and teach obedience to all things that the Lord has commanded. Christians should have large families and ensure they're brought up in the fear and the love of the Lord. This is one of the best things you can do to work for Reformation Revival. Have large families. Be pro-life, because we will outnumber after a while the ones who've had abortions and have been homos. I mean, they're not going to produce the future. It's people who have large families are going to produce the future. Teaching is an integral part of the Great Commission, and therefore it's an indispensable part of our mission. Christian parents and church leaders must give a high priority to establishing and supporting Christian schools and homeschooling. Not everyone's going to homeschool. We've got to reach the people in the government schools as well, or the independent Christian schools. Psalm 78, we will not hide them. What's them? The commands of God from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord. He commanded our forefathers to teach their children, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God. So, communication imperatives. This we learned in military intelligence. 5% of people think. 15% of people think they think. 80% of people never think. Now, if this sounds insulting, it's unbelievably true. Imagine, if you will, a place where people believe that war brings peace, drugs brings health, and debt brings wealth. You've got all these Americans who are convinced that bombing other countries liberates them, and Operation Iraqi Freedom, while they're bombing people, they killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq to bring about the collapse of their civilization and absolute chaos, where ISIS and idiots who are running around chopping people's heads off and blowing up ancient historic monuments and churches have replaced the government that was there before and have created pandemonium and chaos throughout the Middle East, and they call it "We Fight for Freedom." And in every Memorial Day, you know, to thank our soldiers who have kept us free. They've destroyed the lives of people in how many different countries around the world, and they call it freedom. War, bombing other people, does not bring freedom to anyone. Now, defensive war, if people are attacking you and you're defending yourself, that's different. You might preserve your freedom. But you don't bring freedom by attacking other people and bombing civilians. And as for drugs, I mean, that we've got the most unhealthy population in history. The pharmaceutical companies are not making people healthier, they're making them sicker. And we're living on debt. 5% of the people think, 50% think they think, and 80% never think. So for those people who think, you need books, seminars, conferences, and documentation. Libraries. Summaries of books. Want to get people the best book, the Bible. Jay Grimstead has put together Rebuilding Civilization on the Bible, which inspired the title of this presentation. This is a compendium of so many great church conferences and some of the greatest minds and theologians out there to look at the key biblical principles we need to rebuild economics, education, crime and punishment, science and arts, everything on the Bible. We've got great scientists like Dr. Philip Stott, who have taught principles of creation versus atheism. Of course, the Ten Commandments is a foundation of all law. Understanding a history and understanding the threat of Islam. Understanding the history of the largest country in Africa at the time, Sudan. The stories of our ancestors inspire the heroes of our future. The more we know of history, the more we are inspired to a higher standard, because we look back at examples of excellence. Well, that's what we should do. Just the inspiration behind victorious Christians who changed the world. 32 biographies of great Christians from the 2nd century perpetuity all the way through to the 19th century. Mary Slessor. The greatest century of Reformation, learning from the greatest century of missions, sketches from South African history. A house is not a home without cats and books. And there's no such thing as too many books in a house. It's just not enough bookshelves. And the Vikings went out and conquered the world, and today with books we can conquer our minds. Ordinary people have large TVs, but extraordinary people have big libraries. And so we run seminars and education workshops here, open days, where we organize conferences and join in conferences like the Kwasibantu Ministers Conference. People who think need conferences. They need education days. They want seminars. They want documentation, books, audiovisual box sets. And these are all materials that have been produced from our workshops and Back to the Bible preaching workshops to know how to protect our family from the gauge of being in the pink inquisition. These books are part of the ammunition in the spiritual warfare of winning the world war of worldviews, this battle for the mind. Our crash course in worldviews is the Biblical Worldview Summit, giving people in 1 week concentrated exposure in a fun way of body, mind, and spirit to be able to resist the indoctrination of the world. And of course, to get people interested in and orientated for a lifetime of learning in missions and getting involved in missions, the Great Commission course. These are just some of the ways that we seek to cater for the 5% who think. Seminars, conferences, workshops, books, and university online programs like the William Carey Bible College, Bible Institute. For those who think they think, we need leaflets and video documentaries. That's where the average person is quite happy with videos and documents and so on. But for the 80%, you're reduced to sound bites, slogans, t-shirts, and bumper stickers, because they can only think in slogans. They don't have libraries in their head. In fact, you speak to a lot of people. I've heard people say, I haven't read a book since I left college. I haven't read a book since I left school. And the way they talk shows it. So we need billboards. Like, if you must curse, use your own name. Real men don't use porn. Abortion, one heart stops, another heart breaks. Abortion stops a beating heart. Soundbite, short, sharp things that can get through to people. Abortion is murder. ANC stands for abortion, necklacing, and communism. Or abortion, nepotism, and corruption. All works. Christianity is not a Bible verse tattooed on your arm. Christianity is not a cute Hillsong lyric. Christianity is not a one-line in your Instagram bio. Christianity is actively dying to yourself and living for Christ. Now, that's a bit more than one soundbite. It's a few soundbites. But the point is, this is how you've got to communicate to the bulk of people out there, the 80%. It's through a soundbite, a meme, a picture, just basic key things. You've got to get people thinking. It's like trying to kickstart a motor where the batteries flatten, you know. Kickstart again, but after some spark might get through and maybe some light could dawn on this massive darkness inside there. Gay pride is why Sodom got fried. Now, I had a lot of people complain about how I could have posted such, but this got tens of thousands of reach, got thousands of shares. This one post on our Young Reformers Have Changed the World, I think, on that site. And it's amazing. It's things like the snappy, interesting visuals and rhymes can get through to people. Every movement needs to mobilize every section of society. You start with leadership training. Just think of the Reformation. Martin Luther had books, and he had pamphlets. He also had slogans. The American War of Independence. The people were reading books like Lex Rex and In Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants, but their pamphlets all the way down to slogans. Give me liberty or give me death. No taxation without representation. So you need everything from the books and the seminars and the conferences through to the slogans. This is how Americans communicate on their side what Planned Parenthood trusts are. A bit graphic. We go for billboards like this. Life begins at conception. Abortion is murder. Speak up for those who can speak for themselves. Rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. Short, sharp, punchy statements. Now choose life so that you and your children may live. We've got these visuals. Growing, growing, gone. Billboards, visuals, crosses, banners, flags, abortion, the ultimate child abuse. These are the sound bites we're using to try and reach the next generation. Take the high places. A person is a person no matter how small. And on radio programs, you're reaching other people through radio. Of course, our leaflets are for the people who are thinking. We're trying to get through these newsletters. build up people. Not everyone's going to get into a book. The shorter the message, the more people it can reach. But of course, if you want to do depth, you want to take people from soundbites to radio programs, to some meetings, to newsletters, to some books or booklets maybe to start with, and hopefully getting them. And what's the ultimate goal, actually? If you think how our Lord Jesus, he spoke to the masses in parables, stories. And then he spoke to his people in more detail, like Sermon on the Mount. But then to his disciples, he went to even more detail. And sometimes he took the 12 aside. Sometimes he took just Peter, James, and John aside up the mountain and would speak with them alone. And so what is our ultimate goal? If we start with, say, radio, demo, social media, interview, sound bites on TV, a couple of posters and so on, where are we trying to lead people to? We want them to subscribe to the magazine or get on the mailing list or get on the email list or come to the website, come to the bookshop. But the ultimate goal, get them to camps and courses, but what's after that? If you can get people to engage in home education, just think of the difference between attending one meeting or reading one tract or hearing one radio program and a person engaged in years of teaching and studying and working through curriculums, training their children through great textbooks. So if you can get people to commit to educating their children with Christian textbooks, now that is life-changing. I mean, that's big-time investment. Now you've gone way past people just giving up a few hours of their week to them devoting their life to training the next generation. So in a sense, home education is a major end goal. And of course, the idea is that many of those children would end up going into missions, become home educating parents themselves, go into many different fields of service. We need Christian artists. We need Christian journalists. We need Christian filmmakers. We need Christian nurses, Bible translators. There's a wide range of skills that are needed in God's kingdom. But the goal is inform, inspire, and involve. It's not just enough to inform the head. We want to inspire the heart. But we don't just want to inspire the heart. We want to involve the hands and feet. We want them to actually put feet to faith and get out there and do it. So we educate people, yes, but we educate them to enlist them. We motivate them, but we don't just want them to walk out and say, oh, that was great, that was inspiring, thank you, I enjoyed that. We want them to be mobilized to action. We want them to get out in the street for the March for Life. We want to get them to the camps or courses, the outreaches, and ultimately we want to mobilize them to fulfill the Great Commission, starting with their own children. Raw information, such as makes up the majority of newspapers, is cheap. Information is cheap. You can get a lot of information out there. But understanding is valuable. And participation is most precious. Information is cheap. Understanding is valuable. Participation is most precious. That's why one of our main symbols is boots laced up. Do you know the first boots that we had someone produce an art thing was open boots with the laces all wide open. It's laced up, feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. We're talking about Ephesians 6, full armor of God material. We want people to get involved. Now, when you get involved in a life chain, that may not seem like you're asking for much, but first of all, the people see there's other people involved in it, and then they see the response of some, then they wonder why some people are hostile. I mean, what's so bad about standing for life and the rights of life, people and babies? Why are some people angry? And then you wonder, where's the media? And then you wonder, why does the media give so much attention to two homosexuals and a dog, but they completely ignore hundreds of Christians make a stand for life? And people start to lose the confidence in the mass media. And why is the government legalizing this when it's obviously immoral? And some people say, I don't like to see those pictures. Those are terrible. Well, if it's too horrible to see, then maybe it's too horrible to allow it to be legal. You get people involved in the March for Life, and our March for Life is a lot tougher than our life chain because it's not designed as a family thing as such. We have some of the ugly pictures too. We confront Parliament with what life and abortion is. And when a person is involved in March for Life, they go to Parliament and they see the callous indifference of many of the politicians. It also hardens a person's determination. We understand we're involved in the spiritual battle of life and death. Getting involved in missions and more, that's important, that's key. Get out there. reach people, start conversations, distribute literature, balloons, get people signed up. I mean, putting feet to our faith. There's many things we can do and we can make a difference. And so again and again, it's motivate to mobilize, inform, inspire, but also involve, educate and enlist. And then we're getting the people into the next, and we've structured it so that the life chain will mobilize people to the March for Life. The March for Life will mobilize people to the life chain. In between, hopefully, they're educating their community and their congregation. But there's other things we can do to put feet to our faith. Caring for people less fortunate than ourselves, like the Zimbabwe pensioners who are starving, and putting together a few basic essentials that really can make life a lot easier for people who struggle in a country that's destitute, where power failures and all that is the norm. And these boxes of love, just another way of putting feet to your faith and helping people far away. And there's a whole lot of other projects, of course. And the missions to stand and the Bibles. And maybe we can't go there, but some people can sponsor Bibles for these projects. Do you know that most of the Bibles we took into Sudan were sponsored by a blind man's fundraising efforts in Colorado Springs? Brent Noble, who at age 21 had experimental or early laser surgery, and they turned him from a person with eye problems to totally blind at age 21. So the last 21 years of his life, he lived to 42, Brent was totally blind. He would stand at the back in my presentations at Summit and listen. And I, you know, his seeing our dog would be lying at his feet and he'd be leaning on the barricade of the stairs listening. And I felt terrible that a lot of my presentation was visual. So I started describing what was on the screens more than just talking around it. Exactly describing what was there. And he got such a vision for Sudan that this blind man started to challenge the students, because he did devotions often there at the Summit. How much are you spending on Starbucks and chewing gum and all these different things? And why don't you just fast that for a few days and put that money for Bibles to Sudan? And do you know, he raised in 1 year, now that they've got every 2 weeks, a group of homeschoolers comes through, about 120 to 180 sometimes, and they do a two-week course. He managed to raise in 1 year something like $16,000. Sponsored a lot of Bibles. Next year, $23,000. In the end, he raised a couple of $100,000 worth of money donated to Bibles and Jesus Form equipment and audio Bibles and so on to stand without this blind man challenge. And these were kids going to high school and about to go to university. Teenagers, almost all of them. And they all had enough money that they gave more than all the big churches and all the, I've spoken to some of the biggest mega churches around, but he got youngsters just, you know, instead of wasting all that money on your milkshake and your Starbucks and so on, how about contributing those dollars to work to stand? And then he started to have auctions where he'd have slave auctions where the staff would be auctioned out as slaves, and they would then serve the student for so much time for so much money. And so they were auctioned, and that money would all go to Sudan. And so he got innovative, and he raised a lot of money to go to Sudan. And that's what enabled me to charter aircraft and fly in tens of thousands of Bibles into the Nuba Mountains and distribute. A blind man did more than all the seeing people that I've spoken to. And I must have spoken to hundreds of thousands of people since I started working in Sudan in public meetings. And this blind man did more. And when he died in 2002, that was the end of our major Bible distribution sprees in Sudan, because we no longer were getting that amount of money. Now, what does that tell you? I've spoken to some of the biggest churches in America, mega churches where there's thousands of people in every service, and there's three services in a row on Sunday morning. And you could speak there and carry the same amount of literature back as you carried in. Not a book sold, barely no newsletters taken, virtually no questions afterwards. Speaking to some of the biggest churches in the land, and the people just didn't care. And then you speak in a little church in the middle of nowhere, and those people are supporting their a little amount that they can every month for 10 years and helping in the field. And you get a blind man who wants other people to read the Bible that he can't read. and to see the Jesus form and so on. So people can get involved. And I remember we used to have, when I was converted, they'd give you these little tins and you put spare coins, and after a while you take that to Bible Society, and that would fund so many Bibles for Swaziland or wherever. And I don't see that today. There isn't that same passion and interest in caring for people who are not as fortunate as us. So we pray that this new Missions to Nuba Mountains of Sudan film is going to inspire a lot of other people to think, what can we do to help Christians who are persecuted, particularly in Sudan and Nuba Mountains, but persecute church in general. Next week we have the opportunity of the Evangelism End Time Seminar with Professor Henry Krabendom, Netherlands professor, Covenant College professor, outstanding man, a man who hasn't let his academics get in the way of his evangelistic zeal. What an opportunity. Everything that we've been trying to produce in this mission is part of this battle to fulfill the Great Commission and deal with a cultural battle. As Professor Martin Luther said, a simple man with Scripture has more authority than the Pope or Church Council. Scripture alone is the ultimate authority, which is why we've been involved in promoting the 95 Theses for Reformation today, getting people back to understanding what the Reformation is all about and the key principles, and challenging our incredibly hedonistic pagan society with scriptural truths. And Literature of Africa is a key part of this, because we're providing ammunition to spiritual war. Do you know, on my first mission to Mozambique, I heard this. Oh, yes. The missionaries did teach us how to read. But it's the communists who gave us something to read. The missionaries taught us how to read, but the communists gave us something to read. And I looked at this and I thought, this is probably the story of Africa. All over Africa, missionaries set up schools, taught people to read. And then came the communists and gave them communist propaganda and won over a whole generation to their lies, which has led to the deaths of tens of millions of people in the most hideous and violent ways because of communism. Because the missionaries were just teaching them to read, but not giving them enough things to read. And so I started writing years ago to every author I knew. Do you have any books that you can send to us? Damaged books, misbound books, shop soil, doesn't matter. Don't throw it away, don't pulp it, send it to us. We'll use it in Africa. And after a while, some started giving us hundreds of perfectly good books. James Kendi was our best support initially. He sent 1,000 copies of us, brand new, in the original packings. He had just donated by mail, sex, received to us. And this started the work until Eagle's Nest started to consolidate it into containers and ship us tons of books that we can. And you've got to look at these books as bullets, bombs, and missiles, and guided missiles even, in spiritual warfare. Not to destroy, but to save life. Demographic dynamics. 5% of people make things happen. 15% of people watch things happen. In fact, they don't even know what's happening right next to them. There in distance, you can see a lion sitting under the tree. They don't see the one right next to them. 80% of people have no clue what happened. We need to be those who make things happen. We need to renew minds, transform lives, make disciples by teaching obedience to all things the Lord has commanded. We desperately need reformation and revival today. Dr. Martin Luther declared, "If I profess with the loudest voice and the clearest exposition every portion of the truth of God, except precisely that point which the world and the devil are at that moment attacking, I'm not professing Christ, however boldly I may be professing him. Where the battle rages, there the loyalty of the soldier is proved, and to be steady on all the battlefront besides is mere flight and disgrace if he flinches at that point." What's being attacked now? The Bible, truth, history, the family, marriage. So many things under attack. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will stand up for me against the workers of iniquity? We have a calling to smash cultural Marxism and put in its place biblical truth, families, Bible studies. The most constructive thing we can start with is reading the Bible ourselves, then start a Bible study and a prayer fellowship. That's where my mission got started, standing up in the army, asking if there's anyone else who wants to join me for Bible study and prayer every night. And Frontline Fellowship grew out of a Bible study and a prayer fellowship. I think there's nothing more strategic we can do than start a Bible study and prayer fellowship, even if it's just two or three people. That's how we started. but that can go super far. And then, of course, having a family, raising next generation, raising them to not believe the lies of this world, to be people who think for themselves, to be Bible readers, to be people who will not accept things as they are, but work to change everything to the way they should be.